Joining me in the studio is the UK Ambassador Chris Trott. Good morning, Chris, and it's good to have you always on the Miraya Breakfast Show.
Good morning, and thank you for having me back.
Yes, just briefly, tell us about the visit of the UK Minister for Africa.
Well, in fact, we had two senior visitors here in South Sudan this week. The Minister for Africa and a newly created envoy for famine prevention. Mm-hmm. And they came here to South Sudan because there are basically two sets of concerns in London. The first is about the humanitarian situation, as you said, in Bor and in Pibor, which is where we took them, but not just there. I mean, there's flooding across seven of the states of South Sudan. And so we wanted to take our famine envoy, and he was appointed only 2 months ago, but this was his first visit anywhere in the world, which shows, you know, the level of concern in the United Kingdom. And his visit particularly to Pibor reinforced that concern. He came away with a real understanding of the threat that is posed to people in South Sudan by the combination not just of natural causes like the floods, but also the impact of the violence, which has prevented for a considerable time humanitarian organizations from being able to prepare for the flooding that we knew was coming. So this is a double whammy for the people. And then the other reason which brought our visitors to South Sudan was that we are still a little bit frustrated, if I'm honest, with the lack of implementation of the peace agreement. And we really want to see the pre-transitional tasks completed so that there are, for example, state governments in place who can provide services to the people in partnership with international donors and also help facilitate the response to the humanitarian crisis. So the lack of state government in a way in Jonglei and elsewhere has actually made it harder for us to respond to the potential famine as well. So the minister came and he was here to urge the parties to really try and get through the last phase of the pre-transition, which will allow us to talk to the government about Chapter 3 of the peace agreement, Chapter 4 of the peace agreement, Chapter 5 of the peace agreement.
We'll talk about that peace agreement later a little bit more. But for now, any special reasons why Bor and Pibor were chosen for the field visitation in South Sudan? And what were your findings after interacting with the locals? How bad is the situation, if you have to describe for us?
So, I mean, the reason why we chose Bor and Pibor was because I think there is a sort of sense that these communities are probably facing some of the toughest conditions in South Sudan. And the message that we got, we went to a nutrition center, which was just outside the civilian administrator's office in Pibor. What we saw was really shocking. Our famine prevention envoy has been all over the world looking at similar situations. And the level of acute malnutrition, the level of infection of things like malaria, the level of infection from measles because the violence stopped there from being the annual measles injection campaign, demonstrated the really big threat that the people of Pibor face. So we were really very moved by the situation the people found themselves in, which is why I was pleased that our minister was able, even in this sort of COVID environment, to announce an extra $10 million of UK contribution to the famine and the humanitarian response in South Sudan.
Tell us more about that donation, though, the $10 million. Where exactly will it be going?
Well, I mean, the details are still being worked out, but in principle, it will be added to our partnership with organizations like the World Food Programme, the FAO. I mean, we don't deliver the aid ourselves. So we work through partnerships. And I mean, this is why the sort of protecting our partners is so important to us. We need to be working to ensure that these organizations can deliver the food safely. And we need to ensure that deliveries of food and medicine, the clinics we help support, are then allowed to do their work. And I was very upset yesterday to hear in Renk one of our clinics was destroyed as a result of some activity on the ground. This is not the way you encourage humanitarian organizations to engage and to deliver the support that we feel the people deserve and need.
Yes, and this is the thing. When many people hear about these donations, there's 10 million donated, there's 15, and all that amount of millions of dollars being donated. How do you ensure that this money, they just don't hear figures, but they actually see the benefits on the ground, that this particularly reaches them and touches them, that this was the amount of money donated by this good-willed country, and it really affects them, not just the figures that goes to these organizations?
Yeah, I can understand how difficult it is to sort of visualize that and to ensure that that is reaching its recipients. And it's actually something that worries UK taxpayers, whose money this is, as much as it does the potential beneficiaries on the ground. So we have extremely robust systems in place to ensure that this money is translated into help. The biggest frustration in a way for us is that South Sudan is the most expensive place in the world to deliver this food aid. So each ton of food can cost up to $1,000, and only $300 worth of that is the food. What we then have to look at is, if you're delivering food to Peabor, the costs of shipping it there. The cheapest way anywhere in the world is to use a truck or to use a barge. But both the security situation in this country and now, sadly, the flooding means that neither of those options are available. The moment you have to use a helicopter or you have to use food drops out of a big, expensive plane, the cost of delivery goes up. The other thing that we are affected by is the things like the exchange rates and stuff like that. If the exchange rate in this country was floating freely, it would enable us to ensure that more of the money goes on food, or at least more money is bought, more food is bought and delivered with the same amount of money. So there are lots of circumstances that mean that for a donor, this is an extremely expensive place to be delivering assistance. That doesn't mean we're not going to do it. What it means is we need to be very careful about how we do it and ensure that we do it as effectively as possible, which is why we keep expressing concerns when I hear a barge has been attacked or when I hear that humanitarian access is being denied. I mean, this is a hugely expensive operation, and it's disappointing when it's made more difficult and more expensive and more dangerous.
Now, what needs to be done to ensure that at least all this is minimized and the food is delivered as expected to the beneficiaries?
The most effective thing is to build a partnership with state governments to be able to then ensure that the food reaches its recipients. So one of the things we need is a state government. Now, we met both General Konyi in Peabor and we met Governor Dene Chagor in Bor. But they don't yet have support structures in place. There are no state ministers in place. And so it becomes much more difficult if you cannot talk to local partners about what you are seeking to do. And this is the link between the humanitarian crisis on the one hand and the peace process. It's also why we are so concerned about the levels of violence that we saw in Jonglei this year, because that has made it much more difficult for us to deliver. The best way, for example, for WFP to prepare for the floods is to deliver food in advance. But I can't remember the exact figure, but hundreds of tons of food was looted during the violence, which means that the same amount of food has to be delivered a second time at 10 times the cost because we're doing it by helicopter. So we need to be confident that the local government and the partners on the ground can work together to protect food where it is delivered in advance.
Right.
To ensure it stays there and then is distributed to the people that need it rather than being stolen by men with guns.
All right. Ambassador, as we still talk about the humanitarian situation, let's talk briefly about your visit to Bor and Bibor. And the flooding, of course, I do believe you've seen it firsthand. Just give us a picture of what, how it is.
Oh, it's absolutely tragic and really very sobering. So I don't know if your listeners remember, but I went to Bibor last year. It was more or less the same time of year, maybe a little bit later. And I remember wading through the water on the runway, on the airstrip, with the then governor of Boma State, David Yauyau. And we were up to our almost up to our waists in water as we waded from the helicopter to the governor's office. The same is true this year in terms of the levels of water. So what the international community and the local partners and the local people have to do is they have to build mud walls around the very, very few isolated areas of high ground. And those are like little dikes. So when we went from the governor's office, where the water is up to the front step, to the nutrition center, it's only 100 meters, maybe less. But we had to go in one of these amphibious vehicles, and we had to stop at a little dike. We had to climb out of the vehicle onto the dike and ensure that the vehicle didn't damage the dike in any way, and then climb over the dike in order to go to the nutrition center. So these dikes have to be maintained full time in order to protect this very cramped community. And the problem, of course, is that for us, we were privileged because we had access to one of these vehicles. But the people who are bringing their sick children, children who have malaria and are malnourished, the people who are bringing those kids to that nutrition center don't have access to a vehicle or a boat. They are having to wade through water halfway up to the waist in order to get a very sick baby to a place where that baby can get some help. And this is really tragic. And so, you know, for our famine prevention envoy, he came away with a real sense that there is a real threat to the people of this area.
Yes. And with this visit and with the visit of this, your special envoys to South Sudan and visiting these particular places, apart from the $10 million that your government has donated as an addition to what you already donated, what will be the results of this particular visit to South Sudan once they go back? What are there any plans that might change on approach?
Of course. I mean, there are sort of a couple of things. The minister is responsible because our development and international foreign policy departments have just merged. The minister is in sort of charge of our approach. So any sort of request for further funding will end up on his desk for approval. So bringing him here to help him understand the situation is important for us. At the same time, our famine prevention envoy, his responsibility as defined in his job description is not just to come to a country which is at the risk of seeing this kind of famine, but also the understanding is that he is going to go away and he is going to lobby and work with the rest of the international community. So he can now go to New York to talk to colleagues in the United Nations. He can go to Brussels or Paris or Berlin. And he can say, listen, I have seen the situation on the ground. I know what the risk is. And we together need to find a way, even in this COVID environment, when we're all, our budgets are collapsing because our economies are collapsing. We do need to keep finding as much money as we can collectively to support the people who are being affected by this famine through no fault of their own. So there will hopefully be a bit more coordination, a bit more effort in the international community, because the key thing, the ideal thing, would be to stop this getting any worse, to stop it becoming any kind of formal definition of a famine. It's not a formal famine yet, mm-hmm. but it could become one.
All right, let's talk about the peace process. And first, what's your impression about the implementation process right now, as we speak?
Well, you know, I've been following this process and talking to you about this process for the last 4 years. I am, on the one hand, I am pleased that we are still seeing the parties to the agreement working together. Mm-hmm. But I can't tell you how frustrated I am at the slow rate of progress. Because the transition period, or the transition period coupled with the pre-transitional period, was supposed to be 3 and a bit years.
Indeed.
And so we were supposed to get to a point where there was an election in maybe 2021 or 2022, depending on how you calculate the exact period of time. And yet, here we are in 2020, and we haven't yet finished the pre-transition tasks. Mm-hmm. And what I see is that where the clusters, for example, are able to put their different party affiliations behind them and get down to business, we are seeing parties starting to genuinely try mm-hmm. to implement the other bits of the agreement. Because the pre-transition is only really about chapters 1 and chapters 2. Mm-hmm. So they are starting to work on that. But as I've said, we've not yet seen on the ground mm-hmm. the kind of peace dividend we were hoping for, because you haven't yet got that translated through national government into local government, into county commissioners, although I welcome the fact that the county commissioner appointments were agreed, mm-hmm. I think, yesterday or the day before. And so for us, for example, I'm sorry, I'm talking a lot, but,
yes,
you know, for us, mm-hmm. For example, we work on education and health across this country. For that to operate, we need the state Minister of Education to be in place. He is our, or she is our, natural partner. Mm-hmm. For our health programs to operate, we need the state ministers of health to be in place. We need the workers, the health workers, or the teachers' salaries to be paid, because we support the girls in education, for example, or we support the schools. Mm-hmm. But it's not our job to pay the salaries. That's the job of the government of South Sudan. Mm-hmm. And for the longer that there is this hiatus, mm-hmm. the more difficult it is for us to sort of see where the next step is going to come from. So we really want the pre-transitional tasks finished so that we can get on with a partnership built around the rest of the peace agreement.
Yes, Ambassador, I do believe you've been talking to the parties to the peace agreement, to President Salva Kiir and probably Dr. Riek Machar and the rest of the vice presidents. Where is the problem? Why is there delay in the implementation?
The problems are all very well known. I mean, there is one governor that has not yet been appointed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we urged both Dr. Riek, who our minister saw, and His Excellency the President, who my minister also saw yesterday, we urged them to find a way forward that allowed all the rest of the appointments to fall in place. Because although it doesn't get as much coverage, another element that really needs to happen quickly is there needs to be a proper transitional national legislature mm-hmm. agreed and appointed, because the agreement is not yet in the constitution. There are a whole bunch of laws, like some security laws, mm-hmm. that need to be put into legal practice so that they can be then implemented.
Yes. And do you see this as a lack of political will, or it is the lack of resources to implement this agreement?
No, I don't think that the problems are a lack of resources. I think that they are part of a really difficult, and I recognize it's a difficult negotiation between the parties, but it needed to be accelerated. We shouldn't have had to wait from September 2018 until October 2020, so that's 2 years,
yeah.
for the power sharing pie to be divided up. That should have been done in the pre-transition, which was originally supposed to finish in May 2019.
Yes, and this comes to the question of where are the grantors. We had IGAD was part of the grantors that were actually to oversee the implementation of this peace agreement, and now it seems like it has been left to the parties alone to iron out their differences.
I think our envoy, the Sudan envoy, Bob Fairweather, who has been on this show in the past, including in September, they are working very hard behind the scenes, engaging with IGAD, both the IGAD envoy and indeed individual IGAD member states and their envoys. And in fact, our minister, on his way to South Sudan this week, stopped in Addis so he could see Dr. Ismail Weiss, and he could see also the UN Horn of Africa envoy, Parfe Onega. And we are trying to encourage the guarantors, particularly obviously Uganda and Sudan, to remain engaged. But of course, we look at COVID. We look at the fact that in Sudan they're going through a major transition. We look at Uganda and the fact there's an election next year. And you can see that, you know, they have other things they are worried about. But we are saying to them that for the sake of the whole region, the peace in South Sudan needs to succeed. And they have a degree of responsibility for ensuring that this process keeps moving forward. I should say, just on Sudan, that, you know, our minister was very keen to ensure that we offered the thanks of the international community to the government of South Sudan and to His Excellency the President, because what has happened on Sudan has been very significant. Our hope is that that also, that spirit of compromise and negotiation, can be reflected back into the situation in South Sudan to allow us to move forward.
And what is the role now of Troika? What role is Troika playing in the implementation process at the moment in South Sudan?
The Troika is still very engaged with the parties. Our aspiration is to be as supportive, or rather as constructively critical, of the parties as we can be, because we are your major partners. It's not just in the political field, but actually your major sort of humanitarian slash development partners. So we want to see all this come together to allow us, an example, allow us to focus on Chapter 4 of the peace agreement. Because if we can start to see economic progress, if we can see a reform of public financial management, and I'm on the Public Financial Management Oversight Committee, if we start to see those things happen, then the humanitarian assistance that we have been giving for so long can become development assistance. We can work together on the economy, which is what the South Sudanese people deserve, in order to improve their lives.
All right, Ambassador, just before you go, any other final remarks that you'd like to give us?
I would repeat what I always say, which is the international community is with and behind the people of South Sudan. We want to see this country succeed, and we're doing our best to support the peace process because we want to see a different future for South Sudan, the future these the people of this country fought for and deserve to see.
Ambassador, thank you so much. It's always nice to have you on the Mirai Breakfast. So we do appreciate
it. Thank you very much indeed. It's nice to see you too.
Thank you. Yes, and that is Ambassador Chris Trott, the UK Ambassador to South Sudan, talking to us this morning here about the visit of the Ministers for African Affairs and also the Minister of Poverty Prevention. And they are here to actually have first-hand information on what is going on in South Sudan. As you've heard right there, please, if you have any comment or any reaction to that discussion, don't hesitate to share your thought with us, and you will be live on the Miraya Breakfast Show. Our text message line is 0929-693205. My name is Abid William. Good morning.
DJ, play that happy music.